The Green Front with Betsy Rosenberg, Wednesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
I thought the earth was heating up like a foreman grill. I thought the poles were melting like a fondue pot. I was a green bean. I hated SUVs. I used to cringe when cows would cut the cheese. Then I checked the facts. Now I'm a denier.
Welcome to the Green Front. I love that song, even if my producer back in the studio doesn't think it's his favorite. I love it because, well, I grew up with the Monkees. That was my first album, or 45, probably both, and because those words are, you know, of course, a little bit sarcastic, and we need all the humor we can get when this situation is so dire. And someone who has infused a lot of humor, but also serious brilliance, into the climate change debate is my first guest. I am pleased to welcome to the show Greg Craven. He has put together a video that includes 7 hours of fast-talking, you know, substance-filled education and entertainment, really, on climate change and the debate around it. He's also, in his spare time, put out a book called What's the Worst That Could Happen? A Rational Response to the Climate Change Debate. If only we had more rational responses out there in the political arena. So I've been aware of his work for a couple of years, and I'm very pleased to finally have him on the show. Welcome to the Green Front, Greg, and thanks for taking time out of your busy teaching schedule. I should mention that you are a science teacher, a high school science teacher in Corvallis, Oregon. So appreciate the time, and mostly the time and effort you put into these great works. What got you sort of obsessed with this? What took you from being just a Joe Schmo science teacher, as you call yourself, to a global warming geek?
Yeah, it's a sad tale, actually, because it's not that fun being obsessed with it. First, thanks for having me on the show. Thanks for having me on the show, Betsy. It's always nice to talk with other people who are concerned. You know, I was aware of environmental, our overuse of our environment for a long time. And as a science guy, I've been paying attention to it. So I was aware of global warming as a significant issue back in the 90s, early in my career. But it really, when I attended a lecture in college on climate change, I knew all the pieces, but this particular lecturer, this was what fired him up too. And the way he put it together, it all fell into place. And I realized for the first time the magnitude of the issue, that it's not just another environmental cause. It's not even like toxic waste or nuclear waste or soil degradation or salmon restoration. It's entirely different. It threatens everything. It threatens civilization. It threatens our climate, our home, our life support system. And that happened back in the 90s. And since then, I remember I came out just emotionally blasted. I think a lot of people who've had their oh crap moments, as it's called, with when they first realized the magnitude of the problem. I came out and I, you know, went to the library at University of Washington, and it's a big spacious thing. And I looked up and I was just thinking, this is over. We're never going to be able to afford to heat spaces this big. We're not going to be able to build buildings like this because it's going to completely change what we do. And I you know, talked with my students about it. And in my class, I emphasize critical thinking a lot because it's fun and it's useful for them as a life skill as students, even if they don't become a scientist. And scientific thinking really is just critical thinking. So we talked a lot about it, and I really got interested in why there is such a serious disconnect between what the scientists say and the level of certainty or uncertainty there, and what the public believes. And I became very curious as to why that is. And I, in the course of talking with my students and trying to analyze the psychology of skepticism, I came up with a grid, a sort of 2x2 grid that was actually borrowed from one of my computer science classes. And it's not a unique grid, but in it I played with two factors of the climate change debate, and one factor is whether it's true or not, and the other factor is what we do about it, whether we take action or not. And if you put the action yes, no across the top and the true, false as the columns, that gives you four squares, each of which describes a possible future scenario. Like if it's true and we don't do anything about it, we're hosed. And if it's true and we do something about it, then it's not as bad, et cetera. And I sort of posed that to my students. We played with it for a while, and it seemed like it was hard to argue with. I couldn't find any big holes in it. So I'd never seen that argument before, and every time I'd tried to express it in writing, it just didn't work. And finally, it was visual, and the visual worked. But I had you can't write a letter to the editor with a diagram. So
my wife and I put together a 7-hour videotape.
Oh God!
How it all ends.
The thing was, my wife and I just in the spring of 2007, we just got high-speed internet, and I could finally see what this YouTube thing was that everyone was talking about. And that's when I realized I had the medium for getting this grid out because it seemed useful. I hadn't seen anyone talk about it in this way before, so I wanted to get it out and just get the idea out there, so that it could be out there in the marketplace of ideas and see if anyone could improve it or argue with it. And that's when I made the first video that I sort of sparked things, called The Most Terrifying Video You'll Ever See. It was a 10-minute whiteboard lecture on climate change. Really boring, it sounds like.
Not a boring title. You probably got a lot of attention.
I got that from my students. Can you believe that? So my students, they'd helped me develop the grid just in, as we were talking about global warming as a science topic. And they were excited for the video to come out, and I stayed up, all night, the night before the last day of school, and gave the URL to them. But a couple days before, I was trying to come up with a catchy title because that's so make or break on YouTube.
Yep.
And took polls of them, and thank God they corrected me because it would have gone nowhere had I given it the title that I was leaning towards. They came up with the title. I think that was a big part of the reaction.
What was your title?
The previous title, the title I was going to give?
Yeah.
Hey Presto, how to turn a climate skeptic into a climate crusader. We wouldn't be talking that name.
Little long, but...
How boring is that?
You're anything but boring. You are so entertaining and so charming and so funny.
Well, thank you.
And yet, you're delivering a message that's really, really important and substantive, and I just love it. I guess I can't say enough good things about it, and recommend that people see all of your work. So continue.
Well, thanks. I mean, and that's my job as a science teacher is if you're going to get kids to pay attention to science and be interested in it, you got to be excited about it. And that's the reason I am a science teacher is because I just get really excited about it. I never get through my lesson plan because we always end up on tangents that are really exciting about science. And you got to be kind of goofy. You got to be a monkey up on the stage dancing a bit. And you
multiple hats.
Yeah, you got to be not dignified. So I'm fine playing the goofy science teacher because that really is who I am in my classroom, and it makes it fun, and the students seem to respond to it. And the hats, interesting story on that. So I posted The Most Terrifying Video and gave the URL only to my students the next day. I didn't even send it to family and friends. There was no social networking. And so I gave it to 150 students. And by Saturday morning, that was on a Friday, by Saturday morning, I had 300 views. And that was awesome. And by the next day, 24 hours later, it had like 3,000 views, which was – or 300 it started at 30 views and then 300 views on Sunday, and then which was great because that's sort of exponential. And then on Monday, by like 10 a.m., it was at 10,000 views.
Wow.
And that's when it really launched. So it immediately had holes poked in it because in the video I asked for criticism and feedback. And there was a really big hole that I had just sort of assumed wasn't there, or I'd assumed that it was obvious to people that wasn't a hole. And so I immediately posted some responses, and those back then in YouTube there was no way to sort of point to another video from the first video. Once you posted it, you couldn't do anything to it. So no one found those responses, and I felt like I had a chance to influence the debate because I had a device that apparently worked for a lot of people. I had a network that had been created to propagate it, and I had answers to the criticisms. So that's where the 7 hours came from, was doing a full-on project all at once so each video could point to the other video with just a little URL at the end of the video. And that's where the 7 hours came from. And that's where that really was, at the time, I thought was my magnum opus. And my magnum opus, my nervous breakdown, and my enlightenment experience all wrapped into one.
And so after it all went in viral and you put together the 7 hours of video, you were done, right?
Oh, I was so done. I mean, it was hell. It really, because I'd done this all without consultation with my wife, and there was this great urgency to get it out before the train left the station without me, and I felt like I had something that, I had a good idea, and I had the power of viral information that it might actually have an influence in the debate, and I needed to get it out there as fast as possible, because my motivation is I have two young daughters, and I see the potential of how radically different, more filled with strife and difficulty than our generation. And so my papa bear kicked in, and that became the most important thing. And I sort of became an absentee father in my own home. So my wife was essentially a single mother for a long time without me consulting her on any of this, because it was just what I viscerally needed to do, couldn't not do it.
Completely so understand, having devoted countless unpaid hours to my green media career. And it was at one point where, you know, my husband said, you know, you're preaching sustainability. You need to practice it. You're, you know, saving the planet for our daughter, but you're not spending time with her. So I understand that conflict.
Isn't that hard? I mean, that just killed me. And it's nice to hear that it's not just me who's a freak and mentally ill or delusional or whatever.
I call it an environmental illness. Once you know this stuff, you can't unknow it, even if you want.
I know. And I actually feel sad waking people up to it now, because it's selfish on my part, because I want the world to change in order to save my daughters. But it makes people miserable knowing about this, and you can't unknow it once you know it.
A handful of us relative to the global population know it and are acting on it, it's not going to be enough.
Right, which is why I really focus on the viral spread of information, is we've got to get people on board. But I face the same decision every day during that maniacal 3 months. Over the summer, I spent 20 hours a day working on this How It All Ends project. I found every single critical comment I could find until I'd read for a couple of days without finding anything new. I read maybe 8,000 critical comments, and then filled my living room with butcher paper, putting Post-its on it, and then organizing that into the however many hours of videos. And every day, you know, and then school started, and I'd wake up, I'd go to school, I'd come home, and I'd work until 5 a.m., and I would sleep from 5 to 7, and then wake up so I could see my kids, and then go to school and start all over again. And I'd ruined my health as a result. But every day, I had that same agonizing decision that you had, which is, I'm saving the world for my daughters, and I can't not do that. And yet, you know, I'm losing their childhood. They don't have a father right now. And do you keep doing it the next day?
So was it the Red Bull and the pizza that sacrificed your health and lack of sleep?
Yeah. I mean, stress, lack of sleep, and abuse of Red Bull. I started on coffee until my stomach couldn't take coffee anymore, and then diet soda until that wasn't sufficient, and then Red Bull. Ungodly amounts. So
from one ecomaniac to another, what is it about this challenge called climate change that makes some of us lose sleep, you know, spend their savings, drain their bank account, whatever it takes, and then too many Americans, let's just talk about this country, you know, are continuing to, you know, both the public and the politicians, be in relative denial, or at least business as usual. We'll talk about the active denial machine in a few minutes.
Right.
But what is it about climate change? What are the characteristics about it that allow people to not quite feel and taste and sense the urgency that is truly there,
I spent a ton of time on that, because after I was so done, I promised my wife I was done after how it all ends. But just then, the most terrifying video you'll ever see got big attention, AP story and Christian Science Monitor and ABC News, et cetera, et cetera. And I realized, okay, now I've got a whole new audience. And a book agent had said, hey, why don't you write a book? I got sucked into that. It's like, now's my really big chance because I have attention. And it's for book readers, not just YouTube people. So I wrote the book. And as I was writing it to sort of expand on the methods I suggested of deciding the problem that I'd suggested in the videos, I really I really ended up thinking a lot about the psychology of the individual human. And why is it that we agree that the cancer researchers aren't just doing a hoax for the gravy train? We agree that the scientists tell us we landed on the moon and that the Earth goes around the sun, and yet we can't prove either of those. So why is it that there's equal level of confidence in the scientific community as those, but we just don't get it? And the best piece of writing on global warming I've ever read was published a number of years ago by the Harvard psychologist Daniel Gilbert. And he'd been called up by an editor from the LA Times saying, what is going on here? If what the scientists are telling us is true, why aren't we up in arms? And Gilbert wrote a beautiful piece called If Only Gay Sex Caused Global Warming, which was awesome. And he came up with sort of four factors as to why. And it's all about our threat system that our brains, our alert system for our brains. And we evolved being alert to things that are like saber-toothed tigers after us, right? We scan for that. And global warming shares none of the attributes that our warning system has evolved for. First, it's not personal at all. We don't have if a dictator were imposing it on us, we'd be up in arms. It doesn't violate our moral sensibilities, so it's really abstract. If it was juggling kittens or gay sex, then we'd be up in arms. Another is that it's not immediate. We're great. He said the great way he put it is our warning systems are excellent for finding things to get out of the way of right now. Our systems are excellent for getting out of the way of a baseball, but they're not good at getting out of the way of something that's 50 years down the road. And
flight or fight doesn't work in this scenario.
No, because it's and the last one is it's slow, and we're sensitive to things that are immediate, that are personal, that are morally reprehensible, and that are concrete rather than abstract. And global warming shares none of those, so it comes right under our radar screen. And I think that's why we're not up in arms. Plus, it has the whole thing of it demands pretty radical change, and no one likes to do that.
So why is it, Greg, not about believing or disbelieving? Why is that not the issue to even discuss?
Because it's not, look, do you buckle your seatbelt? Is that because you believe that you're going to get in an accident? No, it's because you do a quick balancing of the likelihood of you getting in an accident and the consequence if you do get in an accident. It's really low likelihood, but if you do get in one, it's potentially high impact. So we do a quick calculation and say, well, how much of a hassle is it to buckle my seatbelt, and is that worth it for excluding this low probability but high impact scenario? So it's not about believing whether it's true or not, because we can't say what's going to happen in the future. None of us know what's going to happen in the future. Every day we do risk calculations and we hedge our bets. You know, is it worth driving this fast to get to work on time? Will we buckle our seatbelts? Is it safe? Do I want to take this pill even though it says all these side effects? We do this all the time. It's just that I think because global warming doesn't hit our alert systems and because it demands change from our really cushy lifestyle, I think that our brains just don't want to pay attention to it.
And how is both optimism and pessimism not helpful?
Yeah, so I wrote about that in my book because that actually came from, I live in a co-housing community, which is like a close-knit neighborhood, and my neighbors saw me they saw me rarely, and when I was striding around quickly with my brow furrowed, and she sent me a little quote that said, things are too bad, things are so bad that we can't afford pessimism. And it just really struck me, this whole optimism-pessimism thing, they're both fatalistic. Optimism is the belief that, don't worry, things will work out in the future. And pessimism is, don't even try, things won't work out in the future.
Mm.
And those are both really disabling. Both of those say there's fate, so don't worry about doing anything. So I think they're both sort of disabling and disempowering. And what we really, like when a pilot, his plane is going down, when Sully Sullenberger, the plane was going down in the Hudson, he wasn't thinking, oh God, it's lost, might as well give up. And he wasn't thinking, sweet, don't worry too much, it'll all work out in the end. He wasn't thinking about those. He was thinking, you know what, I have power, some power over this, and it will take all of my concentration and all of my skill and all of my knowledge to focus exclusively on this to influence the outcome. So I came up with that. I can't come up with a word for it, but the best I could come up with was thinking about Rosie the Riveter. from the World War II poster, you know, we can do it.
Yep.
That optimism, pessimism say we have no influence, it's going to happen. And Rosie says we can do it. So Rosieism is the best attitude, the best term I could coin. So I'm open to suggestion. If any of your listeners have anything better than Rosieism, I would like to hear it because I just can't do it.
Well, as Betsy Rosenberg, I've had a nickname of Rosie for many years for some people, so I
there
like
you
that
go.
One.
There you go.
And I, what you're saying really resonates because when I look around, I really see a lot of optimism in the form the way you described it, which is, you know, things will work out. That's the, sort of the American way of putting things off, or, you know, in the past they have for us as a country, but things are changing and people don't really quite want to see that. And also pessimism, as you say, can just paralyze people. So both are very prevalent. What we need, I think you are saying, is pragmatism.
Well, I hate saying I'm a realist or pragmatist because both of those sort of, just as communication devices, because both of those put other people at the defensive because if someone says I'm an optimist and you say, well, I'm a realist, they take that as a value judgment that you're right and they're wrong. Same thing with a pragmatist if you're saying it in contradiction to what someone else describes themselves as. Really, it's pragmatist is closest, but it's really about communicating to other people. And labels often come up with so much baggage that you're not actually communicating what you think to them. You're just triggering what they think about the word. So maybe that's why rosyism is decent, because it doesn't have any baggage. So I don't know.
Okay, we want everybody to be rosiest. why are personal actions, though, not going to get us there?
Because it's too late in the game, and you know this, Betsy. It's, and I know that you're, you know, in your career, you did a lot of here are actions you can take. And I've met the guy and been sort of mentioned by the guy who wrote 50 Simple Things You Can Do to Save the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And if we did that 30, 40 years ago, we could have done that. But that's we've waited so long, and there's enough inertia in the climate system that it's just way too late in the game. And those are useful, but I think, frankly, they can actually be distractions. Because if I change my light bulbs and get a Prius, I feel good about myself and I stop there. And it's not sufficient. And writing my book, I became convinced that the only thing that's sufficient is a World War II scale effort in changing our infrastructure and our focus. And that's where the government dictated the parameters, and the free market was the engine to drive it, and it was the will and the hard work and the ingenuity of the people who made it happen. So we need a war scale effort for it, the war on warming, if you want. But the problem is, you know, per Gilbert, we don't have a Pearl Harbor. We don't have a one event that wakes us up, wakes the sleeping giant.
And you wrote your book in 2009, I think, or wrote did the tape a couple years ago.
Yeah.
So, and yet, as you say, it's much later than we think, and things have gotten much worse politically with, you know, all the Republican candidates, whoever the nominee ends up being, you know, don't believe, quote, even if they once did believe.
I just can't.
And Mitt Romney.
I can't believe that. I mean, that's the way I say it is. It's amazing to me that if you look at polls, belief in global warming is high for Democrats and low for Republicans. And I saw that, and I'm just like, that's surreal. How global warming is a physical phenomenon. And how does your belief about the physical world, how is that influenced by your political beliefs? I just find that, but to me, it's like a Democrat and a Republican are looking out the window, and the Democrat's like, it's raining out there. And the Republican says, no, it's blue sky out there. And the Green Party guy's like behind saying, hey, let me look. But it's just, it's amazing to me, and it's so disheartening.
And if the Republican view could be called, you know, he or she might call that optimism, of course, is foolishness, but it's also dangerous. And it's
incredibly
gone much longer, and it goes deeper in terms of funding than I think any of us could have ever predicted.
Yeah, and that's why, are you familiar with Naomi Oreskes? She's a science historian.
Yes.
She wrote,
also Naomi Klein.
Yeah.
As well, yes.
Naomi Oreskes is, I call her, she's one of my heroes, and I call her Saint Naomi because she wrote a book called Merchants of Doubt, mm-hmm. and she did a lecture on YouTube, it's easy to find, called The American Denial of Global Warming, and she documented the denial machine, the people who are behind this and the techniques they use, and this is the striking thing that she uncovered. It's the same people and institutions and strategies as Big Tobacco. They were the ones who gave Big Tobacco their strategies and their talking points. And there's actually a quote in one of their memos saying, doubt is our product. As long as we can create doubt in the public's mind, then action won't happen. And that's what the denial machine has been now, and it's incredibly well-funded. It's incredibly well-organized. There are just a few people who set the agenda, and they send those talking points out in their network, and the talking points are given lockstep. So the media, wanting to do, you know, fair coverage, gives that equal weight, and that just continues to confuse the issue. When people ask me now, how can I convince someone about global warming? I used to say, read my book. But now the simplest answer, my book is not so much about global warming. It's essentially a decision-making system for how a layperson can make a reasonable decision based on their own values about a complex and high-stakes issue. And I highly recommend it. I'm very proud of it, and I haven't seen anything else like it, and I've gotten that feedback that I have a couple unique devices in there, the grid and credibility spectrum. But what I tell people now what I tell people now, and your listeners can do this and use it, I say just go to the Wikipedia page on scientific opinion on climate change. Just go there, and you'll see that every single mainstream scientific organization and national academy in the world that has issued a statement on climate change says overwhelmingly it's bad, we're the ones doing it, and we better get on it quick. And there are none that have issued a negative opinion, and there's one or two now that have neutral. And when the American petroleum geologists, when they issued one saying it's not true, they had people resigning left and right, and they had an upheaval, and they had revolt within their ranks, and they had to change that. And now it just says neutral. It's incredibly clear-cut.
You offer a rational response to the climate change debate, and yet what I have found is the biggest deniers, the loudest deniers, including all the Republican candidates for president, would never take time to read your book or to watch your tape, and we have never seen Al Gore's movie, and yet they spew arrogantly their opinions that it's not real, it's not caused by man, and if there is any kind of climate change, it would, addressing it would destroy the economy.
Yes.
Au contraire. And so that's what that's my gripe with him. And someone who wanted to be with us today, a regular on the show, D.R. Tucker, is a Republican climate convert. He actually read the IPCC report from 2007 a couple years ago and had a big, eco-epiphany.
Right. No, I heard him on your show last week.
Yes,
it was a nice interview.
Oh, good. My show. Good. So, if every denier would or undecided would actually just take the time, and they never do, to read the science, any information is out there clearly, but they don't. And they're on the wrong side of science, and they're on the wrong side of history.
Yeah.
Why is that not concerned to them?
And this I realized after my book, constantly mulling on the psychology. Psychologists show, you can observe it to be true, we don't make decisions rationally. We make decisions emotionally. Psychologists have studied in terms of who people vote for, and they do not vote on the issues. They do not vote on a candidate who agrees with most of their issues. They vote on who they like. So just as humans, we make decisions emotionally, not rationally. And that's why my message, I was invited to speak to the American Geophysical Union last year. And my message to the scientists, they invited me because there was a whole day
fabulous.
On it. They were essentially saying, we don't get it. Why is public belief in global warming declining even as the science is getting more certain? And my message to them was, information doesn't convince. And that's what we've been doing for so long, is giving information. And psychologists show we don't make decisions based on information. We make decisions based on emotion and connection. So I think my message to anybody who's concerned is don't worry about changing your light bulbs. Don't worry about biking to work. Spend the time that you would and energy you would spend on that, and spend it on spreading the word. Of course, in my videos, I said, spread this video, and that's had tremendous effect. I've had lots of people contact me saying that's changed their mind. But really, it's about, and it's not about scare stories, because we turn off to that. It comes across as yet another environmental disaster story, and the way that's taken by most people is that they're the problem, and that makes them defensive. Really, the only way to do this, I think, is connection, is find out what they are concerned with and show empathy, make a real connection, and then you can point out, hey, you know what, your goals of security for your kids and freedom and liberty, and safety, those are threatened by climate change. There will be no civil rights in a climate chaos world. No one cared about civil liberties, not civil rights, civil liberties when Katrina flooded New Orleans. No one's going to worry about the Ten Commandments being posted in front of the courthouse when the city's underwater. So all of the things that, the deniers hold dear, their values, we share those goals. It's security and happiness and freedom, food, shelter. It's just that because we make decisions based on emotion, it's they see it a different way, and think the threat is different.
What about the emotional impact of cities like Joplin, Missouri, being nearly leveled, and the flooding in Vermont, and the drought and fires in the southeast? I mean, are the dots just not being connected? And even though we can't prove any one, you know, weather disaster is a result of climate change, certainly there's a preponderance of, you know, evidence that this is exactly what the early stages of climate change will look like. Why is that not appealing emotionally to patriotic Americans?
Well, first of all, I have to back up and say, you're asking me questions, yes or no, why questions, and I don't know anything. I just got to, as a science guy, because I preach uncertainty, that's a big reason. It's the only way you can use my grid and come to it, is if you say you may be wrong. So I'm just giving you my best opinions. So the reason that, I lost your question.
We've had these very devastating weather events, and people are dying and losing their livelihoods, and towns being, you know, submerged and leveled. And why is that not, you know, making an emotional connection to what is likely climate change?
Because it doesn't have a mustache. It's not Hirohito. It's a probability, because if scientists are honest in communicating, and they are, they say you cannot attribute weather events to climate. You can contribute the frequency of weather events to climate, because that's what we expect. And this last year gives a good picture of what we might expect, just a small flavor. But the reason that doesn't convince, I think, is because, one, we don't want to believe it, because it's so threatening to us. It's so huge. And if you do, there's a thin line between like scaring people enough that they become concerned, and scaring them so much that they give up. There's a very narrow window there, and and trying to scare them enough. So we don't want to believe it. So we see the tornadoes and we say it's an act of God, and we see a flood and we say that's an act of God, and we don't connect the dots because our brains don't want to, and because it flies under the radar system of our threat assessment in our brains. But on a macabre note, and I've gotten less politic as time has gone on, because I've gotten more desperate about this. I find myself emotionally. I root emotionally, despite my who I think I should be. I find a part of me rooting for natural disasters, because it's going to take a. It's going to take a Pearl Harbor to wake us up enough people fast enough. That's my fear, is that's the only thing that can do it. My hope is spreading information virally will do it, and that's, you know, those are my efforts. But my fear is it's going to take, you know, that we just get hammered 10 times as hard as this last summer.
Sooner rather than later, because time is critical here.
That's so macabre, Betsy. I mean, that's like, you know, people hear this and say they're rooting for, like, 100 million deaths from natural disasters for next year.
It's like rooting for higher gas prices, so people wake up and smell the CO2 and make the connections.
And when I find myself, you know, sort of rooting for the natural disasters and feeling really lousy about that, I think about it, and I think on a weird level it's actually an act of compassion, because I'm a hang glider pilot, and when I first learned to hang glide, and I was on this hill, and there was someone flying back and forth at the top of the hill in the lift, and he was flying closer to the ridge than you should, because air can be unpredictable. It can push you into the ridge if you don't have room to maneuver, just like climate. He'd been a former student of hers, and she looked up at him. She said, "He needs to break his arm. I hope he crashes and breaks his arm." And I thought, my God, what are you saying? Her point was, if he stays in the complacent habit of what he was doing, he could easily be grievously injured or killed until he learns viscerally that he needs to be more careful, and that life can be more unpredictable, and that it's better for him to have a broken arm now and wake up to that than for him to continue on confidently and get seriously hurt or killed later. And I guess that's how I think about the natural disasters.
And when the scientists say we just have, you know, at this point a few more years to turn things around, and when you look around as I do and you see you know, too much of business as usual, too much denial, too much just too busy to deal with it. Sorry, Betsy. Doesn't that perturb you like it does me? Like, these are critical. Every hour counts, and yet we're not acting as if this is, you know, the emergency that scientists say it is.
Yeah, no, I went through a period where I was just very bitter towards humanity. I mean, if you were a person in front of me and you weren't my wife or kids, I just had this animosity towards you because I really saw it's a universal human trait. I've gotten over that now, thankfully. But, we're not doing anything about it. And actually, on a point, you know, you say just a few more years, I found in terms of communication, I've really studied the communication of this. And what works. And at AGU, I was looking at the other Naomi Oreskes and James Hansen and Michael Oppenheimer. They were all on stage next to me during a panel discussion about how to communicate to the public. And I, hearing their answers and the questions, I realized that I don't know what will work. No one knows what will work. But I'm pretty confident from debating the YouTube comments for years about what will not work. And one thing that's not helpful is saying we've got X many years, because we've been saying that for 30 years. And it's a bunch of people take it as crying wolf. You know, 10 years ago they said we have 5 years. And look, it hasn't happened yet. So why believe
but
when they say
happening.
We have 5 years
it
now?
It is happening.
No,
look,
but
I mean,
it's starting to now. But again, like you said, they won't attribute that. So I think it's better to talk. I think this is from Hansen or Amory Lovins. No, it's from Bill McKibben saying, don't see it as an either-or or definite thing. It's like cholesterol. And the higher the carbon levels in the atmosphere, it's like having higher cholesterol. That doesn't mean you're going to have a heart attack now, and doesn't mean you can predict a heart attack tomorrow. But the longer you hang at the higher level, the more likely you are to have an unlikely but catastrophic event. So that's why you need to get down sooner. So I think it's useful for people to not hear absolutes, because they've heard those for ever since Rachel Carson. And to them, we haven't been destroyed. And we're doing better than we ever have in terms of lifestyle and standard of living. So I think when they hear ultimatums again, they just turn off because it hasn't happened yet. So why is it going to? So I think it's better to actually introduce the uncertainty into it.
And yet it takes a long while to turn the giant ship. And once we see the iceberg, it will be too late if we don't start changing course now.
Yes. I mean, that's true. Unfortunately, if you tell, often that simply doesn't work. Fear. Scare stories tend to not work on people. It works great from the Republicans because they've really figured out communication. And what we need is, you know what we really need, Betsy, is we need people on the environmental side to have Karl Rove and to have a Frank Lutz. Frank Lutz is the Republican operative. If you don't know him, definitely look him up. And he's the one who writes talking points. He's the one who single-handed changed estate tax to death tax. And oil drilling to energy exploration, and a bunch of other ones. So we need that on our side.
And isn't it ironic? On our side, we have the facts. We have scientific reality.
Yeah.
And they're smoke and mirrors, and they're winning. They're being successful.
Yeah,
I guess
that's because of our brain.
A lot of money can buy.
And I'm finally getting to the point where instead of railing against that, I'm accepting that that's what it is. That's how our brains work. And if we want to be effective, we need to meet the brain where it is instead of trying to give the brain what we think it should use. So that's why I really focus on climate communication. I do very little. I do almost no conservation at home because, you know, riding my bike, I get there faster with the car, and that time I can use to influence people, you know. But put out a video blog, write emails, send them to your address book, forward my videos or other people's videos. Spend all of your time and energy on spreading the awareness. And don't have time to go into it now, but there's a bunch of features of how that message can be most effectively communicated, and that's in my book and my presentations.
Yes, the last chapter
of the book. You know, make a connection. Don't give scare stories. Find their values. Find out what they want and give it to them. And acknowledge the uncertainty.
What's the worst that could happen is the name of your book. I'm sorry we didn't get to that question. That was my last one. We'll save that for next time. And hopefully, hopefully the worst won't happen.
We don't want to go there.
If people want to watch your envirally popular videos. You can just Google Greg Craven, How It All Ends. Also, highly recommend his book, What's the Worst That Could Happen? A Rational Response to the Climate Change Debate. And I'm glad to hear that what you're advising, I'm certainly doing, trying to spread the word, spread the green gospel, and get a sense of urgency out there while we use compassion and humor wherever we can. So I thank you
for doing that. So.
Thank you. And lots of humor and compassion and a little bit of lunacy in Greg's videos. I highly recommend you check them out. When we come back from the break, you may not know that oil companies can deduct the cost of their oil spills, robbing the U.S. economy of taxes by these giants that are already getting subsidies, of course. We'll find out what's being done to change that right after we come back. You're listening to The Green Front. I'm Betsy Rosenberg. Stay with us.
They got Nobel Prizes, and an Oscar too. Seems like there was nothing we could do. Then came Climate Gate. Now I'm a denier. There is no debate.
Progressive Radio Network, information for the independent mind.